Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Naked Englishman podcast. I'm Richard Vobes. This is the audio diary of my life. On the 9th of June 2025 at just 8 o'clock in the morning, a bit later today than yesterday. It's a Monday morning. The sun is shining, kind of. There is a sort of hazy cloud in the sky. Where is this wonderful summer that we used to have? Hey, hey. Oh, maybe they're chemtrailing. Maybe they're causing weather problems. I mean, whether they're chemtrailing every single day or whether the stuff that is just floating about in the atmosphere is just doing, you know, days of different unpredictable stuff, it doesn't really matter. They shouldn't be interfering at all. Anyway, there we go. Welcome to the podcast. Yesterday was a Sunday. And saw Julia later on in the afternoon. I was working on my book. The sun was in and out, so I was in and out with it all. We managed to do, when Julia came over, we managed to do two chapters. She reads them out loud and I listen. And then these are ones I've worked on. And as far as I'm concerned, those are the good, best I could get at that time. And she still finds little errors in there, or a comma needs to go here or needs to be moved from here to there, and there's a word missing that you, because you get blind, word blind or grammar blind when you're working on the same piece time again, you see things that are not there, or you don't see things that should be there, you skip things and what have you. Anyway, so we managed to do two of those, which was good. Very pleased with that. We were going to do another one, but by the time we got the Essie going and cooking and everything else, we watched a film called The Ugly Duckling from 1959 whilst we were having lunch. I found it on YouTube. A poor film, really, with Bernard Breslow and John Pertwee as the main stars, and lots of the old other, you know, stars that you've seen in as supporting roles, David Lodge and various others. Richard Wattis was in it, and so on. Anyway, it was amusing. It was amusing, but it wasn't great. It was, a B movie, really, on the basis that Dr. Jekyll, his ancestors now ran a chemist shop. And the secret formula that turned Dr. Jekyll into Mr. Hyde was discovered by Bernard Breslow, who starts as a simpleton and then becomes this very adept criminal who gets in with a gang. I mean, it was all very poor script, a very poor script, really. There were some bits in it. There were some comic bits. I mean, it was you know, you wouldn't want to watch it a second time, put it like that. And towards the end, I was thinking, oh, this, it really is lame. But there you go. It was nice to see John Pertwee in the role, in a bit more of a starring role. And it was interesting to see, I suppose, Bernard Breslow. But he was never a leading man. But he was a comedy character. Anyway, that was that. And what else? Well, that was kind of it. I did go for a walk down to the seafront. Oh, we did two walks. We did go down to the seafront in the afternoon. I went nice and early, and then went a second time. It's always good to get some exercise. And I bought some nuts and some banana chips, and I think I bought some licorice. Was that today or was that yesterday? No, yeah, that wasn't today. Obviously, it wasn't today. It wasn't yesterday. It was Saturday. Yesterday, I just went down nice and early, about this time, actually, about 8 o'clock, and took a stroll on a Sunday morning, just to whiz round and then come back to see the sea. And then we did a second stroll in the afternoon. We picked up some fir cones, because they make good lighters, in the park, one of the park. There's hundreds of them on the floor, fir cones. So we picked some of those up in our pockets, and next time I go down there, I should pick up some more, really, because they make quite good fire lighters. Although we buy these fire lighters, which are effectively wood shavings wrapped up in a sausage shape, with, I guess it must be beeswax, that's holding it together, and then you light that, and It's a slow burn, but that's enough to get your kindling going. So all works very well. You can get those online, very easy. Nice simple little thing. So that was that. Well, of course, we did some washing. Mentioning that, there's still a bit of washing on my interior line. Oh, that one's still soaking wet. I'll just leave that one on the line. Bear with me, caller. There we go. So yeah, it's not very adventurous in recent, you know, we went down and looked at the land, as you heard the other day. Yeah, it's all clouding over. It's kind of not warm and not cold. I don't know what the temperature is. I don't know what the humidity is, really. I've got this clock that was given to me. 70 degrees on the hydrometer, or 70% on the hydrometer. I don't know what that means. There's lots of water in the atmosphere, I suppose. 20 degrees, it says, in the thermometer. Which is perfectly warm, 20 degrees. I always thought 20 degrees was the average temperature of people's homes, but apparently they bumped it up to about 23, which seems to me as being quite hot, really. I'm going to put my slippers back on. I've just seen Julia off. So she is winging her way home. Her ex is taking her eldest, but only the eldest, up to see his mother. And so Joe's got... Julia's got Joe, which is a shame, because if he would had taken both children to see their granny on his side, Julia would have had free time to help work on the book, and we could have gone and done a bit of land searching. But it was all arranged a bit late, and I don't know quite why. I guess because Joe is a bit of a handful, and probably the in-law on his side can't cope, if one is brutally honest. So, better be brutally honest then, hadn't one, I suppose. Yes. Just looking at my bookshelf. I tend to do that quite a bit. Here's a lovely book. I can't remember. Oh, yes. The English People and the English Revolution, it's called. I do like to pull off books at random, as I've mentioned many times. I think I'm enjoying R.F. Delderfield. There's a particular in God is an Englishman which I'm reading. I must find out what happens in that, because it is rather grim. There's a train that has come off the rails with the hero and his children. Now, I don't know what this book... If I remember rightly, this book, although it looks nice and it has an interesting subject, I think it's quite dry. I'm just going to try to find the beginning of a chapter. Here we go, and see what this is. The Popular Party and the Party of Order. The English People and the English Revolution. The leaders of the parliamentary opposition to the king had intended to make their man demand... in the second session of the Long Parliament, that in the future the two Houses of Parliament should approve those persons chosen by the King to be his officers and councillors, a claim not to nominate but to have a veto over the King's nominations. And they seized upon their fears generated by the army plots, the incident in Scotland and the rebellion in Ireland, to press this demand. A large number of members of the House of Commons defended the King's prerogative to choose his own ministers and advisers, but the House passed by 151 votes to 110 a representation to the King. That we cannot, without much grief, remember the great miseries, burdens, and distempers which have, for divers years, afflicted all his kingdom and dominions, and brought them to the last point of ruin and destruction, all of which have issued from the cunning, false, malicious practice of some of those who have been admitted into the very near places of counsel and authority about him, who have been favourers of popery, superstition and innovation, subverters of religion, honour and justice, factors for promoting the designs of foreign princes and states, authors of false scandals and jealousies betwixt his majesty and his loyal subjects, enemies to the peace, union, and confidence betwixt him and his parliament, that we have just caused cause of belief that those conspiracies and commotions in Ireland are but the effects of the same counsels, and if persons of such aims and condition shall continue to credit authority and employment the great aids, we shall be enforced to draw from his people, for subduing the rebellion in Ireland will be applied to the fermenting and cherishing of it there, and encouraging some such like attempts by the papists and ill affected subjects of England. Oh my God, it goes on and on and on. Sounds like corruption back then. And when are we talking about? Well, it's the beginning of the English Civil War, isn't it? So 1530-something, 34, is it? 1640s, 1630s. This was originally published in 1976. I'm just looking here. And I guess it's a bit of a study book, this one. It's not like so many other my books. Here we go. What is this? I'll just read a little bit of this bit, which seems a bit more interesting. The Craftsman, it's called, this bit. Alongside these conflicts of the peasants with lords of manors and the crown, there were also conflicts of the craftsmen with merchants and the crown. In those cases where the craftsman did not sell his own products to the public directly, but to a merchant, the livelihood of the craftsman depended on the price that the merchant would pay him, and, in times of depressed trade, on whether the merchant would buy his goods at all. The basic conflicts in industry at this stage in history were between craftsmen and merchants, and these conflicts were concerned with the price and quality of the craftsman's produce or products. The largest industry in England was the manufacture of cloth, which dominated the export trade of the kingdom. The bulk of exports consisted of the traditional broadcloth, which was made in Wiltshire, Somerset, Gloucestershire, and exported to the Netherlands, Germany, and Eastern Europe. Despite booms and slumps, the broadcloth industry remained basically prosperous until 1614. Thereafter, it experienced a series of crises and catastrophic slumps, and from the 1630s onwards, a persistent depression as the result of the long-term contraction in the traditional markets for English broadcloth. Cheaper cloth manufactured on the continent priced English broadcloth out of its own markets. And we see that with the China business, don't we? With them doing all the manufacturing and we can't manufacture anything. I find all this very interesting. But this is where progression has taken us, hasn't it? It's progressed us into a market in which if you can produce it cheaper by cheaper wages, whether they're slave wages or even wages that are actually pretty okay, but if you're able to produce cheaper than somebody else, people buying in will buy at a cheaper price. It's just a natural thing. However, if you are isolated from the rest of the world and your community produces what it needs and you don't need to buy in from elsewhere, and you all contribute to things, as would have been the case, I suppose, in the days of the Saxons, when people were growing sufficient and what surplus they would just sell, but they were pretty self-sufficient on their farms, basic livings, I grant you, then you didn't have that sort of problem, the race to the bottom, and continually having to change what you do, and in the end, as we've seen here, become the poor man, sadly, because you've gone into manufacturing. And then you ask yourself, well, do you really want to be in manufacturing in large scale? Because what kind of job is that for somebody, really? You know, weaving all day long, as we saw in the Industrial Revolution. And in China, what kind of life is it? Whereas it seems to me much more rewarding to grow your own stuff, to be able to sit down and enjoy the sunset, to be able to look after your own cattle and not have all the trinkets and stuff. You know, you do want some material and stuff, as in clothing, but you don't necessarily, but you could have, we've got the techniques and knowledge to make self-sufficiency work a lot better for us, haven't we? I'll just read one more bit and then I'll finish off. Most of the cloth was exported from London by a small number of big merchants who held a monopoly of the trade as the dominant group in the company of merchants, adventurers. Again, it's like, there it is, you know, some people just took advantage of everybody else by going, we're the ones that you have to go through to sell it. The great merchants of London had always believed that regulations were necessary in order to ensure that the cloth was made uniformly, honestly and well, and they'd been able to persuade the Crown to accept their views. The London merchants provided the driving force behind a series of laws in the 16th century which fixed the length, breadth, width and method of manufacture of various types of cloth and set up searches to see that the regulations were observed. Well, again, some bunch of people have said it's got to be this wide, it's got to be this long. Surely if you're buying a piece of cloth, you would say, well, I want it this, I want to make it this, you know, could you make it to this? Or the manufacturer of it would say, well, we've made it this big. If you want it, you want it. If you don't want it, you don't want it. Again, it's that sort of standardization of everything which takes away people's imagination and inspiration to do an innovative stuff. No, no, it's got to be this side, it's got to be that. It's the sort of McDonald's and Costa Coffee type thing, or Starbucks coffee. It's like, yeah, we've standardized it now. We've standardized your houses. We've standardized your town. It can't be innovative, different, artistic or anything else. This is how it's rock solid, which is, you know, a bugger. So they sent out these to, you know, people to go and have a look at it. But periodical attempts by the central government to enforce the laws led to conflicts with the cloth makers, quite rightly so. In the West Riding of Yorkshire, in the reign of Elizabeth I and James I, clothiers resisted the efforts to suppress tenters, which were used to stretch cloth into a uniformity of length and breadth after it had been fulled, and were successful in getting the ban relaxed in 1623. In Gloucestershire, in the reign of Charles I, the clothiers resisted the efforts to suppress mozzing mills, which were employed to raise the nap of the cloth after fulling, and at length persuaded the Privy Council to relent and to permit the existing mills to continue while maintaining the ban on the erection of new ones. But the reaction of the merchants was to blame the fall of exports on the defects of the manufacturer and decline in the quality of cloth, and to demand more efficient enforcement of the regulations. The government of Charles I accepted the advice of the merchants and in the 1630s intensified the efforts to see that the laws were executed and the quality of cloth maintained. And I mean, I just find it interesting. We can see there merchants were the ones who needed to standardise. Now, can you understand to a degree you're selling something, you don't want poor shoddy workmanship on one product and something brilliant on another. You know, we have people who claim that you buy a car and if it's a crappy old car, it must have been the Friday car because it was the end of the week and everybody was looking forward to the weekend. But my argument would be that really and truly, if you can motivate people to do the best they can and not have slave type jobs, if you've got slave type jobs, nobody wants to work on that. But people who love making cloth, people who love making clothes, would do the very best they could. And, you know, we need to sort of pull people up, not level them out and standardise things. Personally, that may sound like a load of old rubbish to you, and maybe it is. I need to put a jacket on because I've opened the window and now I feel a bit chilly. So I'm going to upload this and then get on and do my video of the day. And I will catch up with you anon. Thank you very much for listening if you did, and have a wonderful day. Till then, bye-bye.